This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. As protests and demonstrations against racial injustice and police brutality continue to sweep the nation, there are major conversations happening about race in the United States, and some are trying to navigate how they can best participate in this conversation, whether that's in the workplace, at home, or on social media. Interpersonal dialogues about race can be hard but important. Today we talk about how we can better participate in these conversations. And if you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment. We will do our best to get it into the conversation today. That is 866-476-3881, because you're the part of this conversation as well. And we have four panelists with us. Kimberly Crowder is joining us via Skype. She's CEO and founder of Kimberly Crowder Consulting. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks. And just as a correction, it's Kim Crowder Consulting.
Kim Crowder Consulting. All right. And you're joining us via phone. All right. And Michelle Anastasia is a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter. Michelle, glad to have you with us.
Thanks so much. Happy to be here.
And we also have two members of the Indianapolis-based group Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE. Laura Rinderknecht, great to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
And Kelsey Stringham-Marquis is with us as well. Thanks for joining us today, Kelsey.
Thank you.
Kimberly, Kim, you're CEO and founder of a consulting company. One of the things that you do is help provide guidance to individuals and companies alike about how to talk about race. So in a moment, when we're seeing nationwide protests and proposals for considerable policy change, why is it important to look at how we talk about race at an interpersonal level?
Sure. I think what's interesting in companies, what I'm hearing back from so many people, is that the people at the top don't know how to have those conversations. And I think that really speaks to where we are as a country in general about who gets to talk about race and who doesn't, and when and where. And so I think it's extremely important that organizations recognize and not be silent about this, because that silence feels like complicitness to their employees, and it creates this kind of invisible space where they don't get to tiptoe into. And so the more that leaders can become inclusive in their personal lives, they become more inclusive in their professional lives. And I just think at the end of the day, we spend so much time at work. Why aren't we having those conversations that directly impact all of us?
So a lot of people see this as a political issue. And whether or not you agree with that, I guess, is something we can talk about. But if a company sees this as a political issue, and they're a company that doesn't wish to get involved in politics, and so their silence is expressed, I guess, in that way, what would you want to say to them about that?
What I would love for companies to say is to just be honest and authentic and say, we don't get it. Mm. We haven't done the work internally. We don't have all the answers, but we want to learn. And so those companies that feel like this is political, we're talking about humanity. This is not political, but it is political, right? But at the end of the day, if you're going to hire people who represent all diverse backgrounds, and you hear organizations tout that as being something that they use as a selling point, then they've got to do the work internally in order to make that real. We want to see receipts today.
Laura, the organization you work with, Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE, has helped to provide some guidance for folks, particularly white folks, about how to have these kind of conversations. And we'll talk more about that. But can you first explain the work that SURGE does and who you partner with?
Yeah. So in Indianapolis, SURGE has been in action for about 4 years, though we're a chapter of a larger national organization. And the work that we do is mainly having conversations with white folks who may be new to the work, because what we know is that sometimes, especially right now, there's a lot of white urgency, and people feel like they need to do a thing in order to be involved. But sometimes one of the most important things to do is to slow down and to listen and to learn, so that we can build on the work of activists that have been doing this work for the last 400 years. So I say a lot of times that SURGE is kind of a launching point for white folks to get involved. and a place for us to process some feelings that we may be having that wouldn't necessarily be appropriate to process in a multiracial space. Like if I said something or did something and then got called out on it, it would probably be best to process that with other white folks so that I can work through some of my own issues to better show up in a multiracial space. Locally, we are accountable to several organizations that are in Black Lives Matter, one of them being Indy 10, Black Lives Matter. We're also in relationship with IUYA, Indiana Undocumented Youth Alliance, with IMPD, and with the American Indian Movement.
We are talking about how to talk about race today on All In, and we have Kim Crowder, CEO and founder of Kim Crowder Consulting, with us. Michelle Anastasia is a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter. Laura Rinderconnect is with us as well from Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE, as well as Kelsey Stringham Marquis. Michelle, as a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter, how important is it to consider who we place responsibility on to act as the educator?
It's such a large part about teaching folks about their internalized racism and the white supremacy that we're all taught from a very young age. It's important for people of color, Black people specifically, to be able to have those conversations when they want to or have emotional and mental capacity to do so, but is even more paramount for white allies or white accomplices in this racial justice fight to step in and have those conversations so that Black people don't have to continue to do that emotional labor all the time.
And Michelle, we had you on a show with us last week, and thanks for participating in that conversation. And in that conversation, it was brought up, I can't remember by who, maybe it was you, but I don't want to put this in your mouth. It was brought up that white people need to be listening more than talking, and need to defer to the people of color at demonstrations and protests and their message, and have your message, if you're a white person and you bring it with you, to be sort of, looked at and almost approved before it's put up on a sign, perhaps. And so when you hear about an organization like SURGE showing up for racial justice, do you see that as sort of an active way that white people can become educated and further their listening? Or does it go a step beyond just listening?
Yeah, that was me that said that. But I love SURGE. SURGE is my recommendation for white people always and forever. Amen. I always, always first recommend people that before they even show up at protests, that they should inquire with SURGE, and so that they can start doing some unlearning. Because what happens is we get people who are very excited. They've just figured out that there's racism in America and in the globe. And so they're like, what can I do? I'm going to show up for a protest. But they haven't started to unpack anything for themselves. And that lack of unpacking creates danger for the Black bodies that we're protesting to protect. So my suggestion is always for folks to go to SURGE. And that then translates into everything, because then you won't get those signs that are microaggressively racist at a protest to protect Black lives, because people don't know yet, because they haven't started unpacking everything yet. So my suggestion is always for people to go to SURGE first before they start to go in further, because protesting also isn't the only thing that you can do to fight racism.
Kelsey, we know that race is a topic that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. Can you talk about where that discomfort or fear around these conversations can come from?
Sure. I think it can come from a few different places. I think that particularly as white folks, we are very much socialized to not be comfortable having those conversations. And I would say the other thing that I've noticed in my work with SURGE is that sometimes it can come from a place of perfectionism and wanting to do everything exactly right. And so thinking that, well, if I just learn how to do it, then I'll go out into the world and I'll be this perfect anti-racist. And then in fact, that's not actually how it works. I see a lot of white folks who, you know, want to get involved, but are hesitant because they are worried that they might do it wrong, or they're worried that they might not do it perfectly. When in fact, that's just part of the work, is making mistakes. So I think it can come from different places. You know, that perfectionism I really notice. And also just that, you know, we as white folks typically have not had to have these conversations about race. You can grow up and function in society as a white person without really needing to confront this. And that's part of our white privilege.
Laura, was there a time when these conversations were hard for you to have?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. We were actually doing a training that Serge led last week. And in that training that we were leading about, hey, white people, here's how you can talk to other white people with a strategy called calling in. I actually said something that was ableist. I used ableist language, meaning that I used a word that wasn't honoring the full humanity of somebody. But it was a phrase that was very much, it's a part of our culture. And I think that's what's so interesting about all of this, is we don't necessarily see it because it's so ingrained in our culture. But I used it while leading the training. And somebody wrote me an email and called me in on it. They told me that I messed up. And I could feel some of this shame of doing this in such a public venue kind of creep in. And then I realized, oh, no, I this isn't about me. This is about others. This is about humanity. And I think 5 years ago, I would have gone down into what Brené Brown calls a shame spiral for not having done something perfectly. But through the anti-racism work, it's helped to ground me in connection with others as human beings and, you know, remind me that it's not about me. It has helped me to decenter myself, decenter my whiteness. Sometimes you'll hear folks say in the activist world. And it's been a gift if somebody is willing to invest that time in me.
After a quick break, we will be back with our panel to continue today's discussion about discussing race. And if you have questions or comments for our panel, you can send them our way. Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We are back in 90 seconds. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about how we talk about race. As always, we would love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. Today we're joined via Skype, by Kim Crowder, CEO and founder of Kim Crowder Consulting. Michelle Anastasia is a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter and joins us via Skype. Two members of the Indianapolis-based group Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE, are also with us, in Laura Rinderknecht and Kelsey Stringham Marquis. And so, Michelle, we'll start with you in this segment. A person's comfort level in talking about race will be influenced in part by their own race and lived experience, of course. How was race talked about in your family growing up?
It was something that was just general kitchen table discussion. But I'm Black, so it's not something that could be avoided. I also grew up in Indiana, so surrounded by white people, majority white people around me always. And so it was always something that impacted my life, from being the only Black person in my entire elementary school, or the only Black person on this team or that team, or always being the only one. And there have always been times when that has been a reflection or something that stands out from issues that my parents have had. at employers or with interactions with people. But it's just always been a conversation, being taught how to be around police officers from a very, very young child. Those were some of the first initial serious conversations I remember having as a kid, was how to protect yourself and how to keep yourself safe around people who don't have good intentions towards you because of the color of your skin.
Kim, you've said that something to consider before having these conversations is whether or not people are ready to have them. What do you mean by that?
Sure. I talk to a lot of organizations who, frankly, people are clearly not ready in the ways that they are unwilling to talk about race in general. I mean, that's a high indicator. But also, it's an indicator when people just absolutely have a real, what's the word? It's almost like a hostility towards it. And that happens at every level of an organization. Particularly, it can happen in upper-level leadership. And also, you see that in ways where upper-level leadership looks very much so one way, and that is usually white male. And so you have a sense of how did it become white male, because there are some conversations that are not happening. The same reasons that people aren't having these conversations in everyday life are the same reasons they don't have them in work environments, which is why I like to talk about inclusive leaders leading inclusive lives and making real work, doing the real work around that in their personal lives. So what I mean by someone not being ready, sometimes I can dip my toe in the water and just listen about how people talk about race. If they talk about it in ways of, oh, our company's perfect, or our company doesn't have any problems around that, oh, our leadership is totally inclusive, and then I go on their website, and their website looks like what I described, then you know that maybe there's some real barriers there in having that conversation, or that we can start somewhere else, but we can't start at this general, you know, talking to your entire staff because your staff is not ready. And what that creates is trauma for the underrepresented, particularly Black people who are there. And my point is always to make sure that everyone in the room feels safe. Everyone in the room feels heard, and I will not put Black employees in a position where they're being battered around having these conversations.
Laura, Surge teaches about a particular strategy that we've talked about already called calling in. I want to expand on that. What is calling in?
Yeah, I think one of the best ways to describe calling in is by talking about calling out. I can think of multiple times in my life where I've been called out by somebody, where maybe I said or did a thing and they didn't like it, and boy, they let me know. And when somebody is called out, usually people get pretty defensive and kind of shut down. So in Surge, when we talk about calling in, it's something that we as white people do with other white people, and that's an important distinction. But it is using and leveraging relationships that we already have with our friends, our family, our neighbors, and our coworkers to engage them in a conversation on race and racism that they want to be a part of. So we're not going to say things like character attacks, you know, you're such an idiot if you believe X, Y, or Z, or, you know, if you believe this, you can unfriend me right now. Because our belief is that we as white people need to do that heavy emotional labor, like Michelle was saying, of educating and calling in other white folks to the racial justice movement. And it's not something that will be solved in one conversation, but really leveraging and building on the relationships that we have with people.
Kelsey, can you talk about the conditions or dynamics where calling in would be appropriate to engage with and times when it would not be?
Sure. I think that it really is so contextual. But we are pretty clear about times when calling in is not the best strategy. As Laura mentioned, you know, we never expect Black folks or people of color to call us in. That is, you know, not a thing that is appropriate to expect from them. The other time that we find it to not be very effective is calling in people in positions of authority or positions of power. Just because of the power dynamics inherent there, You know, when you are in a position of authority or a position of power, you have a different kind of accountability. And that doesn't always work well with the calling and strategy. Sometimes there's a need to hold public officials or people in leadership positions to hold them accountable in a different way, that is not the same as calling in. We find that calling in works best when it's someone that you have a relationship with, like a friend, a coworker, a family member, someone who you know and who you will have a sustained long-term relationship with. Sometimes it can happen and is very effective on social media platforms. Other times it's less effective there and needs to be an in-person or conversation or a phone call. And that is all contextual as to, you know, the nature of what someone said or the nature of your relationship with that person.
Michelle, there's been conversation lately about the difference between productive and performative conversations about race. Can you talk about the difference or examples of where you see it?
Okay. So there is examples of performative work are going to be things like when you see people and their whole Facebook or Instagram wall is Black Lives Matter and in police brutality, and they're posting all these videos and all of this information and content, but they're not actually backing it up or making it applicable to their everyday life. So that means that people sometimes just have access to something, and it's very easy to just hit post on or share on any sort of social media, but it's much harder to spend that time going inside to think about what are the ramifications of white supremacy as it reflects in my everyday life. What is my contribution here? What am I really trying to unlearn? There's a real grit and hurt to thinking about the destruction that we have all caused to each other and to ourselves as we have contributed to white supremacy without going through and unlearning those behaviors that were taught to us and those concepts that were taught to us and those ideals that were taught to us. And when I say white supremacy, I mean it like broad strokes. So I'm talking racism, I'm talking ableism, I'm talking capitalism, I'm talking patriarchy. I'm addressing all of those things under the guise of what white supremacy hath wrought in this nation. So when people are performative, they most of the time aren't digging any deeper. They usually will use things like model minority qualifiers and apply that to situations. And then they'll try to like reason things away. Whereas if you're digging deeper and getting into some of the grit of what we're really trying to do, the justice and equity, society equity that we're trying to create, it's a different perspective. And just as one of the ladies from Surge was saying earlier, that if you are calling people in and bringing them in to awaken themselves a little bit more, then you can continue those conversations. And that's when it becomes non-performative and it really becomes about you as an individual.
We are talking about how to talk about race today with Kim Crowder, CEO and founder of Kim Crowder Consulting, Michelle Anastasia, a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter, who we just heard from. Two members of the Indianapolis-based group Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE, are with us, Laura Rinderknecht and Kelsey Stringham Marquis. Kim, people have reached out to you and asked how they can come alongside people of color and show support with their words and their voice. What do you suggest to them?
The first thing I say is learn. Do some real work. There are a lot of great books available. You know, what's interesting to me is I hear a lot of people say, they ask that question, how do I help? And my first thought is, you know, we research everything. We are on Google about everything. And so empower yourself to start where you can And that is to start doing your own homework, because what we need are folks who are ready to own their pieces of this. And so the sooner that people are willing to do that grit themselves, the better. I am also, I'm hosting a course soon, a workshop, as a matter of fact, to talk about some of this. As you want to join in on the conversation, what does that look like? And I think it's interesting about how many people have finally in some way woken up to this thought. I'm glad to see so many people joining in. It still concerns me that there's such a chasm in understanding about what's been going on in this country since it began. And so my goal is to educate people about that part of it. How did we get here? What's the history that you don't know about that is not in the books, that you never were required to learn? And how do we start having conversations around what the past is so that you get a real sense of what systematic racism looks like in this country and how you may benefit from it? And then for those of us who do not benefit from it, what does that really, really look like? And then how do we start having conversations about moving that forward in your personal everyday life? You're a rock in a pond and you can ripple out. So what does that look like for you and your inner circle?
Kelsey, if someone wants to talk about race with a friend or a family member, you know, it can be challenging to just know how to start the conversation. So do you have any suggestions on how to break the ice?
Yeah, one, there are a lot of strategies you can use. And one thing, you know, I think an entryway that many people have into having these conversations is in response to something that your coworker or your friend or family member has said. And so in those instances, you know, we really encourage people to get into a place of authenticity. And come from a very genuine place and start asking very curious questions. So trying to understand, how did that person get to the conclusion that they've just drawn? What was their thought process? What were the sources of media that they were consuming that helped them get there? You know, what have they heard? What have they felt? Asking questions and then genuinely listening is a really helpful way to start creating that shared space where those real conversations can take place and real change can occur. You know, I think that, you know, one thing that came up in the training that we just had is, you know, if your friend or family member hasn't really said anything, but you're just wanting to bring it up and you're not sure how to start, you know, one suggestion is, if someone asks you how you are doing, you can take that as an opportunity. I think a lot of us are socialized to say, oh, well, I'm fine. Or like, I'm doing great. You can say, you know, I'm doing okay, but I've really been thinking a lot about George Floyd, or I've been thinking a lot about, the protests and here are some thoughts. And I was wondering if you would have these conversations with me. It can be scary if you are doing it for the first time, if you're not used to having these conversations, but it is so important that all of us get into a brave place with starting and initiating these conversations and continuing these conversations.
And Laura, if we are to have these conversations, it's hard to tell sometimes whether they were productive or helpful. Is there a way to measure that? Is it just a gut feeling, or does it go further than that?
Well, it would be awesome if it was a clear black and white answer. But unfortunately, in this work, it's much more nuanced than that. There may be conversations that you have with somebody and you feel like it doesn't go very well and you didn't get to the end of you know, the end goal of where you wanted. But then maybe a month later, somebody else has another conversation with that person and they're a little bit farther along. And maybe in 5 years, something happens and they go, oh, that's what they were talking about.
Well, and Laura, you and Kim have known each other for years. How have conversations about race played a part in your relationship and your own growth?
You know, our relationship and our friendship, was pretty solid. But I think as we both became, or let me use I statements as a white person, as I became more aware of how racism is impacting the world, the country, but also how racism is impacting me as a white person. You know, it was a gift to have somebody who we could have a back and forth dialogue about race and racism and how it's showing up in our lives. I think I've been able to give Kim some insight into why white people sometimes get defensive. But she's also gifted me with a lot of insights and helped me to grow. And, you know, I think when you have that relationship and you're able to build on the friendship, we can have conversations with each other that I can't necessarily have with other people. And I remember one time I said a thing and Kim lovingly said, you know, don't ever say that again. Don't ever do that again. And at first I thought, oh gosh, you know, this is it. The friendship is over. Mm-hmm. Because I think in white culture, we're very much socialized to be nice and to not disrupt things. And one of the things that I really value about Kim is that she loves me enough to hold me accountable for my actions and to make sure that I am showing up in this world as the best version of myself.
Laura Rinderconnect and Kelsey Stringham Marquis join us from Surge. And Michelle Anastasia is with us, a member of Indy 10 Black Lives Matter. Kim Crowder, CEO and founder of Kim Crowder Consulting. Thank you all. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on how we can have better conversations about race. It's a tough enough topic to wrangle for adults, but for children, where do you begin? What is age appropriate for them? And how does the identity of our own families inform these conversations? Here to help us work through some of these questions is licensed psychologist and associate professor of psychology at IU East, Dr. Beth Trammell. Beth, first of all, did I pronounce your name correctly?
You did. You got it right.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
And as always, we would love your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. So, Beth, this is a topic that can be overwhelming for us adults to process, let alone to then explain to children. What would you say to a parent who says they don't know where to begin?
Yeah, I think, you know, like you're saying, often this feels bigger than what our kids will really see it as. You know, our kids take our emotions and they take our behaviors and they mimic the way we respond. So I think the first thing that I try to help folks realize is they really need to first commit to this conversation. And like Kim and Laura and Michelle and Kelsey were saying earlier, this isn't just a one time we're going to talk about George Floyd or one time we're going to talk about race. This is, you know, an ongoing conversation, and parents have to first commit that they are going to join the conversation and really do the work to do that, because by committing, then they will do sort of the necessary steps to develop the awareness and continue to learn new things. You know, we wouldn't expect that we tell our kids one day, hey, be kind, and then we don't have to talk about being kind anymore. You know, we want to talk about something important that falls within the values of our family or for our parenting philosophy. We have to know that we have to have continued conversations. So the first thing really is to realize you have to commit and then do the work to develop awareness and prepare for that. And also to realize that it's not going to be an easy conversation. It may not be something that you feel super comfortable talking about. And to what everyone has already said so far, it's about being genuine and saying, you know, I don't really know, or my experience with this is I didn't have a whole lot of experience. And so I'm learning along the way as much as you are.
Well, and along those lines, regarding parents who just don't feel equipped to have these conversations, what do you say to them?
Yeah, so it's usually the thing that most parents get paralyzed by, right? They're like, well, how do I even start? What should I say? They're looking for like a specific script for what should I say? And So first, I use this in the trainings that I do or the talks that I have. I talk about this acronym for hard conversations of any kind, but PRESS, prepare, reflect, explore, share, and then reassure. But really, it starts by preparing what you want for them to know. So prepare the facts ahead of time based on the age of your child and what it is that they need to know. And as you are preparing, you're also reflecting on your specific child, or if you have more than one, like what does each child need specifically to understand about the scenario? For our little kids, we just need to start teaching them about differences and accepting differences when they're really young. Kids notice very early differences in all sorts of different things, but especially the difference of skin color. And so we have to begin having that conversation as early as possible. So as they are preparing, then the first thing I usually say is for parents to gather information about what your child already knows. So asking a question like, well, tell me what you know about George Floyd, or what have you heard about protests that are going on? By gathering information from what your child already knows, you can help clarify any misconceptions, but then it also tailors the conversation for where you want it to go.
Well, and along the preparedness lines, are there common questions from children that parents should be prepared to answer?
Yeah, for kids, it usually comes back to safety. So either psychological safety or physical safety. So they may ask questions like, well, would this ever happen in our city? Or would this ever happen to you? Or would this happen to me? Or would people make fun of me if this happened to me or that happened to me? So they're usually revolving around the issue of safety for themselves and safety for us as parents, or the safety of people around us. So if we get into the topic of police and you have an uncle or, a family member who is a police officer, then we can anticipate questions related to safety around those particular family members. And I think the other thing to realize is that our kids may not necessarily have questions right away for us to be paying attention to, but our job is to just plant seeds over time. So have a small conversation now and then again, tomorrow or maybe in 3 days. And we're just planting little seeds that over time, we're giving our kids the opportunity to open the door to have ongoing conversation with us. Because if we're not, they're getting information from other people or on social media or, wherever else they're gaining information. And that may not be what we want them to do.
So I have two children, and I don't want you to just help me. I want you to broaden it, of course. But I have a 3-year-old and an almost 1-year-old. The almost 1-year-old, we'll get to him in a few years. But the almost 3-year-old or the 3-year-old, I want to talk to him about this because of the moment we're living in, and because I feel that he's smart enough to get at least some of it. How do we tailor the conversation to the age of the child?
Yeah, it's really great. I think it's thinking about how do they experience people who are different from them in their everyday lives. So, the artwork that you have on the walls at your house, the books that you read, the toys that you have, the television that they watch. So take notice of how people that are different from them in all sorts of ways, including race, how are people portrayed around them? If they're totally absent, then we have the opportunity to pull in resources. There's oodles and oodles of lists for, books for kids. So you could start by just reading more diverse books and then talking as you're reading the book about what do you notice about this character? What do you notice about this person? And oh my gosh, look at this person. And you can start by just planting seeds that way. And as you think about when you go out into the community, maybe you have a church or at your job or Think about other ways to diversify the world around them, because that is going to be the key to having those conversations, even when they're really, really little.
And so are these conversations that we're talking about, I mean, are you having them in your own home, or have you?
Yeah. So I have four kids, a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 6-year-old, and a 4-year-old. And we have conversations about race fairly frequently because my kids are mixed race. And so they have experienced already some of the different maybe things that you wouldn't necessarily want your kids to experience at school or out on the playground or that sort of thing. So we've had conversations about particular comments that friends might say to them about their hair or their skin color or things like that. So we have, pretty frequent conversations at least once a week, sometimes every day. It just depends on the scenario. And, you know, I think it's important for us to realize that while today we're talking about race and we need to continue to have a conversation about race, as, you know, others on the call have already said, we need to be talking about a bigger picture here for our kids, too, that not everybody is going to look like them or act like them or love like them. And we need to be prepared to teach our kids the expectations to accept and love and be friends with people, regardless of how much or little they are like us.
Today, we're talking about how to talk about race. And specifically in this segment, we are talking about how to talk about race with children. And we are talking to Dr. Beth Trammell, of a professor of psychology at Indiana University East. And so how will these conversations look different within families of different races, say a white family and then a black family?
Yeah. So my experience and talking to people in my therapy room and all different ways is that white folks, it's part of our privilege that we don't have to have these conversations daily. And my experience is that, you know, I think it may have been Kimberly that you were saying that you've had these conversations almost daily for your whole life. And so I think we have to realize that it's our privilege that we don't have to have these conversations, whereas many other folks who, they experience race quite differently. So it can vary from family to family, obviously, but I think for the most part, it is part of the white privilege that they don't have to have the conversation.
And I think I can relate to that. Like when I, and again, my children are young, I haven't felt the need to have these kinds of conversations just yet, although I'm recognizing that I'm at least on the edge of that freedom at this point. And I am white, my children are white. And so when we read a book that has characters who don't look like my son, you know, I don't draw attention to that. And I don't know that I do that on purpose, but I don't draw attention to that because I want him to see humanity first and foremost. Is that also a product of my white privilege, would you say? And I'm not offended if you say yes.
Well, I would probably say yes, but it's also, I mean, I'm white, so it's part of my privilege growing up too. It's only since I've had kids that I have realized kind of the day in and day out. And, the more you do this work, the more you realize, as long as you are in it to continue to learn and get better as a person, we're all going to mess this up. Even those of us who, call ourselves allies or activists, or it's just the nature of the culture that we live in. And so our kids notice skin color, and some studies are saying as early as 6 months, some are at least in the preschool range. So they notice skin color. And so it's not something that we are, you know, kind of planting racist ideas by saying, hey, so what do you notice is different? What do you notice is different? Or what do you notice is the same about these people of you and I? So it's okay to notice, it's just not okay to use that to discriminate. And so noticing is not the problem. And in fact, this narrative of colorblindness, I'm sure is, I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, I hope. But if we're not acknowledging skin color, then we are missing out on huge parts of identity. I mean, we're not just talking about just skin color here. This is, you know, it's their identity for folks whose skin color is not white. And so we're missing out on that by saying, oh, well, you know, I think I'm a good person and I want to acknowledge that I don't see skin color. I just see everyone as equal. And that's just not the truth. We just know that that's so that myth needs to really just kind of die.
Are there ways that we can frame these conversations that we should avoid, or is avoiding the conversation in any way actually a bigger concern?
Yeah, I think our discomfort with it is going to challenge us and make us sort of want to avoid it. But really, avoiding the conversation is silence. And we already know, we kind of talked about it already, that silence is being complicit with, the other side there of any ism, really. So it's really just, one, recognizing your own fear, your own anxiety, and know that all of us experience a certain level of discomfort to talk about all of these things. So just know, you're never going to feel like sitting down to talk about race. You know, it's just going to be uncomfortable. We're going to step away from it. But we can lean in to that discomfort and have hard conversations, even if we mess it up. Our kids are okay when we mess things up. In fact, I, you know, preach parenting, and I'm a parenting researcher, and I still mess up parenting every day. So our kids can tolerate us messing up. Again, as long as we are genuinely committed to doing the work that needs to be done.
From where I sit, and again, I'm a white person, and so correct me if whatever I say seems wrong, but from where I sit, it seems like the reason we don't have a lot of these conversations is it's a term that came up in the previous two segments, the shame spiral, because it's so easy to shame someone if they get something wrong. But what I'm hearing is that it really should be okay if we get something wrong, because it means that we learn something on the other side of it.
Yeah. I mean, here's the beauty of kids. I mean, our kids usually don't shame us. Usually they can just appreciate us for trying, or, you know, they learn from us in making mistakes and how we bounce back from making mistakes. Our mind, our history, our own, inner demons, let's say, those are the ones that shame us, but it's usually not our kids. Our kids are usually like, yeah, mom, I know, it's okay. I mess things up sometimes too. Or, well, let's just learn together. I mean, for the most part, I find, white folks are avoiding this conversation, one, because they're just uncomfortable talking about it with anyone, especially their kids. But then second, we have this illusion that our kids either aren't old enough, or they can't tolerate such a hard conversation, or it's too complex for them to fully understand. And frankly, that's just not the truth. Our kids are capable of having much deeper, much more complicated conversations than we give them credit for. And again, even if we just plant a little seed that says, you know, there are things going on in our country right now, I just want to share just a couple of things with you today about it. Or maybe you start by watching a video of something put out by PBS, or there's lots of great videos out there now, even if it's just tiny bits of information at a time, and then ask your child, like, so tell me what you think about that, and share your real reaction to it. Our kids are much more equipped to handle these conversations than we perceive they are.
Dr. Beth Trammell is a psychologist and associate professor of psychology at Indiana University East. Thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate being here. Thanks a lot.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about solar energy in Indiana. In the meantime, we're on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thank you so much for listening. This is All In.